Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and the health of our communities, of our earth, water, air, of our food, of our society, of planet Earth. Each week on Connect the Dots, we draw the connection between our personal health seeking and social activism, action on behalf of health on community, social, and global levels, or the opposite, action against health and the environment. As many of you know, regular listeners, we've extensively covered what I call the secret trade deals, the treaties, Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, and the others. On today's show, we have a returning guest and a new guest, both, who have really been leaders and organizers in the movement of raising awareness about the nature of corporate control via the trade deals that are coming down the pike. We covered them extensively last year. The president was given fast-track authority last summer, and now some of the details of some of the treaties are getting finalized and things are moving forward, and today's guest will clue us in exactly on how. Margaret Flowers, MD, who's been with us before, is one of the co-directors of It's Our Economy, along with Kevin Zeese, our other guest. Margaret Flowers is a Maryland-based pediatrician who's been very active in favor of single-payer health care. And Flowers views the struggle for health care as part of a broader social, economic, and environmental justice movement. And Kevin Zeese, her co-director at It's Our Economy and in a host of other ventures, is an attorney who's been a political activist since graduating from George Washington University Law School. He works on peace, economic justice, criminal law reform, and reviving American democracy. Well, that's a tall order and something we very much need. They also co-host their own radio program called Clearing the Fog, which airs on We Act Radio. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
So you have been organizing events. You've been covering this topic in your own writings. You've been highlighting actions, and you have been one of, you know, really as a team, the early organizers and whistleblowers via your Flush the TPP website and organization to really raise awareness about these trade deals and what they're all about. Can you update our listeners where we are today? You know, here, you know, as the details of the deals have been nailed down, you know, it was said that perhaps they would be voted on in a lame duck conference at the end of 2016. But here, as we, you know, kind of are at the beginning of the year, where do things now stand?
Thank you, Allison. So the president and the other leaders of the other TPP countries completed negotiations on October 5th. On November 5th, the president stated his intention to sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That triggered a 90-day period during which the public and members of Congress were allowed to read the text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It turns out it's almost 6,000 pages of very technical legal language, so a lot of organizations have been combing through that to find out exactly what's in it and actually discovered that it's much worse than we thought it would be. The president has signaled that he will sign the agreement on February 4th with the other leaders of the other countries in New Zealand. And so people are gearing up to protest that. Then the next step is, after he signs it, that legislation has to go to Congress called implementing legislation. And this is really all of the laws that need to be put into place or changed in order to make the Trans-Pacific Partnership go into effect. So that legislation is being written by the White House, by the administration. And it's really under the president's control when he sends that to Congress. When he does send it, that triggers another 90-day period under fast track, under which Congress is required to vote on it up or down. So really the timing depends on when the president thinks that he is going to have enough votes to pass it. this is a very tough year, and that's to the, you know, congratulations of the movement for being able to stall fast track for so long that we've pushed this fight into an election year. So it's a tricky time. And Kevin may want to comment on that timing.
Yeah, well, a couple things. First, the reason we got access to the TPP text was not because they wanted to give it to us. In fact, the White House and U.S. Trade Representative said that they were not going to make the text public until 4 years after it had been ratified by Congress, as absurd as that sounds. 4 years after it was
amazing.
Ratified.
Amazing.
It's totally amazing. It's so anti-democratic. And the reason why we are able to see it now is because during the fast-track fight, there was a massive movement developed. We must have made hundreds of thousands, if not a million, phone calls into Congress. We had protests all over the country and in Washington, D.C., emails and petitions. There was this constant barrage of public action. And they really couldn't get it passed. They were having a hard time getting it passed. And the president had to compromise in order to get enough votes. And they got, by the way, just enough votes. It was the exact number of votes they needed. And one of the compromises they made was letting us see the text before the congressional time period began. So that gave us a big opportunity to see it and to understand it and criticize it, educate people about it so they can be mobilized to stop it. And that really, I think, helps us a lot going into this next phase. In this next phase, in Congress, you know, there's been a lot of mixed signals from Congress. Mitch McConnell, the most powerful senator in the Senate, who is the majority leader, Orrin Hatch, who's the most powerful on this issue as the chairman of the Finance Committee, have both signaled some opposition and some concern. Senator McConnell has said that we might be better off waiting until 2017 in order to, you know, deal with this issue because we can renegotiate with a better president. In the House, it's been interesting to watch how that unfolds. It's much less open than the Senate has been. Paul Ryan, the new speaker, has said that they're going to review it, and if it's good for the economy, they'll push forward. There have been some members who had not read the text before who have now come out against it, including Republicans. So there's been some positive movement already. There's definitely been an aggressive effort by the movement to already start to push Congress, push back on Congress. Another interesting factor in this is the you know, election year. We have obviously Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders has been opposed to the TPP from the beginning. He's opposed all these trade agreements, and he's been very effective fighting that. On the Democrat side, both former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Martin O'Malley, our former governor in Maryland, have said they oppose it. Now, Hillary Clinton has a history of supporting these kinds of agreements, so we're not putting a lot of stock in that, but thank goodness she said that. We can use that to our advantage in this battle. On the Republican side, you also have candidates who oppose it. You have Donald Trump, who has been very outspoken, saying it's a bad deal, shouldn't pass it, badly negotiated, he could do better. He wants to negotiate it. Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio oppose it as well. So you have an interesting mix of candidates, pretty much all the top-tier candidates, who are saying they're opposed to the TPP. Now, if they actually took action, you know, if Donald Trump could be convinced that he has to show he's a real man and challenge Obama, show his power and strength over Obama, maybe he could do a lot to galvanize more Republican opposition. You know, Hillary Clinton has a lot of key people in the Senate who supported the fast track, who could be convinced by her to oppose it. So if these candidates were pushed by all of us to actually do more than just talk, to actually take action, that would be a big benefit to helping to stop the TPP.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that struck me in what you said is that, and I recall this from when, you know, I began covering it. It was kind of like, well, it couldn't be that bad. How do we know? We don't know for sure because we can't see it. And so, therefore, you know, the implication was we give it the benefit of the doubt. But as you pointed out right away, it's incredibly anti-democratic to be passing a treaty that is such a deep, dark secret. And, you know, I'm interested in, you mentioned that when finally seeing it, it turns out to be worse than expected. Can you give some examples of that?
Sure, I can start, and I'm sure Kevin will want to add a few in. I think one of the One of the worst parts of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is what's called the Investor-State Dispute Settlement. And this is a trade tribunal that works outside of our U.S. judicial system, which is, it's like an arbitration court. It has three corporate lawyers who take leave from their job and serve as judges. And through this tribunal, corporations can sue governments if the laws that we have interfere with their profits, their expected profits. Under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there are more than 9,000 foreign corporations operating within the United States, which are given that investor state dispute settlement status so that they can sue our government if our laws here in the U.S., you know, maybe we raise wages or we require environmental protections or worker protections, if those interfere with profits. But our own corporations that are here at home don't have that same power. So it gives them an incredible advantage. Another piece that's been concerning is the fact that these corporations that are operating within the United States can also bring their own workers in. So we've seen under the past agreements like NAFTA that we get a deficit of, you know, corporations outsourcing their jobs to other countries. Now we're kind of calling this insourcing. It's instead of moving their operations out, they're just moving other workers in, and that displaces our own workers. So those are some areas of concern.
Yeah, in addition, the environmental chapter is very clearly weaker than agreements negotiated by President Bush. There's absolutely no enforcement, no enforcement of any environmental standards. And so that's actually going backwards, and that causes some problems. We saw, by the way, I just want to add on the trade tribunals, which I think are very controversial. People are very upset about it. We've already seen two laws forced to be repealed because of a NAFTA trade tribunal. One involved the country of origin and labeling for meats, so we have to no longer tell consumers where meat comes from. The other is the safety for dolphins in tuna labeling. On both those, the United States was sued and lost, and so those laws will be forced to be changed. The third big one that just was announced a few weeks ago was the issue of the KXL pipeline, where TransCanada has now filed suit against the United States on that. We can be forced to build the KXL or pay a lot of damages to TransCanada. I think the most important thing, though, really is the overall direction that the TPP and these other Obama trade agreements push us. What you can see in this TPP and what we've seen in leaks of other treaties is that they are pushing us toward a more financialized, capitalist, neoliberal economy around the world. And what I mean by that is it'll be more public services turned into privatization and commodification, so corporations can profit from public services. It's going to mean less protection as far as regulation of the big banks. You know, we're in this time this year where it looks like we're going into a pretty deep collapse, and this just makes the fundamentals of the economy, the U.S. economy, which are already have lots of problems, makes it now a worldwide challenge. We're going to see, for example, around the world, more pressure to move toward an Obamacare model, where the insurance industry is in charge of healthcare, rather than what they have in New Zealand and in Japan and Australia and a lot of Europe or European countries and Taiwan and other countries that have a public health approach, where it's a public good paid for by the government and not something that's privatized and commodified, a for-profit system. They'll be forced to move from a human rights public good model to a privatized commodification insurance-dominated model. And we'll also see these single-payer systems around the world pressured on the cost of pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceutical drugs have a tremendous power under the TPP to debate, ensure they get the prices they want, make sure that the cost of advertising, for example, is included in the price of the pharmaceuticals. So all the problems you have in U.S. healthcare, we're now going to export around the world and make pharmaceutical drugs more expensive, healthcare more difficult. So it's hard to look at anything in this treaty and see much positive, I got to say. Maybe it's my biased mind, but I look at this as exactly the wrong direction at the wrong time. Hyper-capitalism, it's financialized by big banks dominating the economy.
What about banking per se? Because, you know, here we have a severe dip at the beginning of the year in the stock market, and the protective laws that were put in place so that we didn't ricochet into another deep nosedive like 2005. I mean, what do the treaties, what do they do with banking laws that protect the economy that way?
So part of the reason that we're in the situation that we're in is because of, you know, deregulation. This actually goes back to the World Trade Organization in the 1990s when Clinton passed the WTO that required that we repeal a law called Glass-Steagall. And Glass-Steagall mm-hmm. was designed to put a firewall between regular banks and kind of investment institutions. And by dissolving that wall, suddenly the banks are at risk. If, you know, investments crash, then the banks can crash as well, as we saw during the housing bubble in 2008. And I don't know if your listeners have seen the recent new movie Big Short, but I certainly recommend it if you want to understand the extent of corruption that goes on within the banking and investment industry. And so the Trans-Pacific Partnership and these other agreements are further deregulating those financial institutions, that so that they're taking down even any protections that we have now, and that will make us even more vulnerable. And if we want to get into, if you want to go further in discussing this, we can talk about kind of the changes that have been made since the crash in 2008 in terms of what it will mean to us as individuals during the next crash. But Kevin, maybe mm-hmm. you want to speak more specifically.
Well, one thing I wanted to add was that one of the changes that's being made that's another example of it going in a worse direction is that financial institutions and these big banks have been given the power to sue under the trade tribunal system, the investor state dispute system. They didn't have that power before. So now big banks can sue. So you can imagine, poor country like Peru or Vietnam or Malaysia, and they want to make sure they can regulate the banks that are coming into their country, or they see that their banks are behaving in bad ways, as they do in our country, committing widespread fraud, and they want to pass some laws to prevent that. Those little countries can be sued by Goldman Sachs or by Bank of America or by J.P. Morgan. Mega banks with unlimited resources can bring these little poor countries to court, to this trade tribunal, fake court. And what that means in the end is that these countries will not pass laws to regulate banks because they'll be afraid to. And so it's really a disaster not only decreasing regulation, but increasing the power of these banks.
The other quick thing I'd like to add is that also it gives the banks more flexibility to leave, to cross borders. So, say that a bank has a lot of money in a particular country and that country is not behaving the way that it wants that country to behave, it can just threaten to pull all of its money out, and that can be devastating for some countries. So this is another area of concern.
You know, it's funny because very often, I don't know if you have this experience, but when I tell people about the trade deals, run into people or talk about them, refer to them or whatever, so many people that I encounter have a kind of knee-jerk reaction. I described to somebody that the trade deals are coming up for a vote, and they were like, they could be voted in, and then we could withdraw from them at will if we wanted to. Or people say, the courts of the land will overrule that. That's unconstitutional, So we, how persistent will these deals be, and what kind of wiggle room that we would always have trusted would have been there will be taken away because of them?
Really interesting area to think about for a couple reasons. First off, once you're in, it's very hard to get out. You can't just withdraw because your politics changes. It's almost impossible to get out. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, our courts, even the U.S. Supreme Court, would have no power to overrule a decision by the trade tribunal. So our courts are actually weakened. I think that's, you know, for Article III constitutional, you know, Article III federal courts to not have the power to review these decisions, just to me is makes no sense. I can't imagine that's constitutional. The problem, of course, is finding a way to get into court, having standing, and ensuring the courts will not try to avoid responding. And they have various ways they can do that. So those are two things. We don't have the power to get out. We don't have the power to overrule. In addition, the banks have more power. You know, they have the power to take nations to suit. They become more powerful than countries. And so that's kind of a frightening prospect to have something like, especially if you understand the corruption and fraud that we saw in the 2008 collapse and that we still see existing today, have people who are willing to commit that kind of fraud and willing to rape and pillage essentially, you know, governments in the United States, local governments around this country, imagine having that power over countries abroad is a rather scary thought mm-hmm. to give that power away to them. The other thing that's really important is that there's several chapters in the TPP that actually give trade negotiators the power to change the agreement without any congressional review. So this is a living document that can that now the trade authorities can actually legislate through these trade agreements, and Congress has no say over whether they accept that or not. So it gives away the Article I power, which is the congressional power in the Constitution, away to trade tribunals. Obviously, the president has no power over signing those reforms either. And we also have in this an authority for ensuring that all laws and regulations are consistent with the TPP. And so we are required to set up an office that will monitor regulations to make sure they don't violate the TPP. So it really totally turns democracy on its head, minimizes the power of every aspect of democracy and the courts at home, and maximizes the power of these unelected trade negotiators.
So the whole thing where you write your congressman, tell them how you want to, you know, they should vote to, you know, kind of act on your wishes, that almost becomes irrelevant in this kind of situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw that in the repeal of the COOL laws, of the country of origin labeling, that was a very popular law. People like to know where their food is coming from. And the members of Congress, we were actually up on the Hill when it happened because we were fighting fast track. They had to march over to the Capitol, and mm-hmm. the House had to vote to repeal that law to get rid of it. So it's amazing, and it even will have an impact down to the local level. You know, for your listeners will probably be, you know, share this concern is that, you know, part of the reality of the climate crisis and the economy that we're in that is so predatory, because of that, people are putting in place new local economies, and this is really critical. So trying to increase their food production locally, you know, trying to push for more organic foods and foods, you know, where you know that it's coming from, or putting in place, you know, community banks that actually lend money in the community so that businesses can get a foothold. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to be pushing, you know, to get rid of that, even at the local level. And that comes through the Buy America, you know, banning Buy America provisions, which will start at the federal level. But within 3 years, at the local level, we will also have to give equal preference to foreign corporations to provide the services that we have in our communities.
And something like Buy America is a way for the government to stimulate the economy when we're in a recession. They can put in provisions that they're going to do XYZ action, and that they want to buy American in order to stimulate the economy. They want to hire American workers, hire American firms. And in the future, that won't be anything that can be done. I mean, U.S. firms would have to compete on a so-called level playing field with Vietnamese firms, despite the reality that they have a wage that's about 65 cents an hour. We obviously, our average wage in this country is about $20, $27. and we're pushing to make those higher with the effort to raise it to 15 for everybody. So that kind of a provision that allows the government to spend money to get us out of recession won't be available. It'll be a tool that will not be available in when we have an economic collapse.
How is this an advantage to Americans?
Well, I think these kinds of trade agreements really serve the transnational corporations.
Mm-hmm.
They serve the oligarchs in the nations around the world that are signing onto it. They may serve, like the dairy producers in New Zealand, if they're a big enough lobby to push for something. So maybe the dairy farms in New Zealand will benefit, or, you know, different aspects of each country can find various industries there have enough power. Well, that's basically transnational corporate power in order to benefit from these. But for most people, it's not going to be a benefit. It's going to be, we're going to see in the United States a continued increase in the international trade deficit, which has been at record highs since the late 1990s, mid-1990s, since we started putting in place these new version of trade agreements. And every time we see, international trade deficit, that means the hollowing out of our economy. When your steel mills close and you buy steel from China, our trade deficit goes up and our economy gets more hollowed out. On every area of that manufacturing, that's what you're going to be seeing. And it's not just going to be limited manufacturing, but any area of the economy where we see jobs exported, we're going to be seeing, a trade deficit. That means our economy gets weaker.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It benefits mm-hmm. politicians, who want to collect donations from transnational corporations. It benefits politicians who want to make speeches in front of big banks in Monsanto. It benefits politicians who want their sibling, their children and spouses and family hired at these transnational corporations. It benefits all of the corruption that infects our government and infects our economy. That will all get stronger as all these kinds of agreements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's terrible. And yet it's really odd because people are more worried about the intrusion of government. And it's kind of like, you're concerned about the guy over there that you think is going to pick your pocket. And, you're basically, being stripped down by someone else and people can't see it because they think this is the direction from which wealth and success is supposed to come to me, something. I mean, I hate to ask this question, but, do the majority of American people, are they aware of this? Are they prepared to do something about it? Or have people just gotten to the point where they're so overwhelmed by all of this, they can't even, see their way past any of it?
It's over the years that we've been working on this, and there has
uh-huh.
been, a really solid media blackout, except for independent, media outlets like yours and many others that have been spreading mm-hmm. the word so dutifully about it. We have reached a lot of people.
Yep.
So I wouldn't say that a majority of Americans know about it, but a good number who are getting activated and taking action. And since this year started, we're seeing a really uptick in the number of people that are coming to our website, flushthetpp.org, who are signing the action pledge, who are organizing, actions locally. So I think that's good news. But I just wanted to kind of step back a little bit and put this into an even bigger picture, because
mm-hmm.
I think what many people are not understanding, and our members of Congress, to be honest, when we talk to them, none of them are thinking big picture. All of them are thinking about whatever constituents in their district may benefit, like maybe the
mm-hmm.
pork farmers or businesses. But globally, there's a push, and it's through the World Economic Forum, which meets every year. They created something called the Global Redesign Initiative in 2010. And this is an idea that actually has been floated for the past 50 years, but hasn't really surfaced too much, is that actually it kind of operates on the belief that nation states or countries are very obsolete, that they're too slow, they're too clunky, they block progress, and that transnational corporations are much more efficient, and they already determine so much of the distribution of goods, of, labor standards, and that we need to start empowering transnational corporations so that we can, you know, grow this global economy. And that's a very scary direction. I think that's the struggle of our time, if you wanted to boil it down to the fundamental struggle. It's corporate power versus people power or democracy. And that's really what the Trans-Pacific Partnership and these other sister treaties are about. And that's why we really must galvanize to stop them.
One other big picture issue that doesn't get talked about very often is how this relates to global hegemony of the United States and these Western corporations. It's not a coincidence that we're doing the TPP at the same time that the military Asian pivot is occurring to encircle China. The TPP does not include China. It's an effort to undermine China economically. And so that's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence that we're negotiating the trade agreement with Europe, the TTIP agreement with Europe, at the same time that NATO is surrounding the European border with Russia with tanks, with bases, with missiles pointing at every major city of Russia. So these military actions and these economic actions are really all part of the same global empire. And I think when people who are anti-government start to think about these issues, I think if they go just a step more deeply, because a lot of people on the right who have that kind of view of government's bad also see crony capitalism, which crony capitalism is basically is corporations getting unfair benefits because government gives it to them. But they start to look at it really as the corporations and the two big parties are really a hand in a glove. You know, they really are part of the same thing. And so our job as activists is to weaken that power structure that creates these, you know, corporate political parties and this big business, big banks, financialization of the economy and the big media apparatus that, you know, blackouts, things they don't want the public to know. So our job as activists on all these areas is to challenge these blocks. I mean, our major website is popularresistance.org. And what that website is it includes a lot about the TPP and the trade agreements and those battles, but it covers all fronts of struggle, labor issues, environmental issues, indigenous rights issues, health, everything is covered on that. And so, you know, we popularresistance.org, I think, shows us the way out. We need to organize solidarity across these issues. And TPP is one of those issues that is a great opportunity to show that kind of solidarity because it affects everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly does. How TPP is one of several different treaties, and you mentioned the TTIP. You know, one of the things that, and I'm just raising that because one of the things that I hear in the health world a lot are, you know, mentions of the fact that, for example, there are difficult food additives in foods in our country that can't be regulated away, and children have a negative reaction to those. You know, they may have a health issue because of them, and it's frequently things are frequently said like, "Oh, you know, Europe won't allow that in their food," and you know, and so there's this kind of, "Why do we have it if Europe doesn't have it?" So it's, you know, an attempt to kind of look out the door and see what's going on globally, which I really salute. But what will be the effect, you know, so I think some of the more aware or health-concerned people in this country kind of look to Europe. What will be the effect of the trade deals on, you know, Europe, for example?
Yeah, this is really interesting because, you know, we've seen for a long time that people in the European Union are very activated around food issues. They've been very strongly resisting genetically modified organisms in their food, genetically engineered foods. They've also been, you know, very much opposed to pesticides and the neonicotinoids that, you know, impact the bees. In the European Union, they actually have legislation that uses what's called the precautionary principle, which we do the opposite here in the United States, which means that something has to be proven to be safe before it can be put into a consumer product. And so that's why, you know, the quality of not just their foods, but also the toys or the clothing or the other things that people use, you know, are better for health over there. So the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership if the United States has its way, will undermine those high standards that the European Union has and bring them down to the United States standards. So, which is kind of a theme with all these agreements. They're driving a global race to the bottom, you know, the lowest common denominator for everything. And that's an interesting, you know, the United States has been the most aggressive negotiator in terms of lowering these standards, requiring that other countries lower their standards. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, if they can even pass TTIP in the European Union, because, you know, just back in November, they had a mobilization in Berlin. 250,000 people came out in one day to protest, and they delivered 3 million signatures. So there's a tremendous amount of opposition over there, and we hope that that stays strong.
What do you think it is? I mean, do you think it's just years of advertising and everybody made the assumption that all of this is fine, and if it weren't fine, you know, we'd know about it? Or, you know, there's kind of an assumption going on that we don't have to keep our eyes upon this, although I think more and more people are really concerned and aware, and, you know, parents and everyone, that all of this stuff has a kind of additive effect. You know, Margaret, I just love to ask, you came out of medicine, you came out of a concern for health and healing. How do you look at our society, you know, in terms of as a healthcare practitioner? You know, what's your perspective on the choices we're making, the way we're going, why we're making those choices? I mean, you know, do you ever kind of put on, like, your health classes? I'm sure they're on all the time. And sort of consider that? And, you know, I'd love to know how you think of that, you know, how you view that.
I would say that being a pediatrician is, you know, it has had a tremendous impact on my activism. I mean, it's actually why I do what I do, and I very much view things through a lens of public health and safety. And so if we look at our, you know, country as a whole, one of the things I realized during my fight for a single payer or Medicare for all health program is that just giving people access to health care in this country is not going to solve our problems. It's not going to significantly improve our health outcomes, although it will help. But that we have to look at the broader picture of exactly the food that we're eating, the way that we structure our communities that really you know, drive people to be more isolated, more sedentary, the way that the pharmaceutical industries have such influence with direct advertising to people of their products and really pushing the public to believe that they need to be highly medicated, that even things that we consider normal behavior are something that should be treated. Looking at the environmental pollutions here in Maryland, we're fighting the largest trash incinerator to be built in the United States that's being put into a low-income, already polluted minority community. We're looking at a fracked gas refinery in southern Maryland being put into a community that with no buffer zone. They should ideally have at least a 10-mile buffer zone between these refineries and residential properties. And this one, the properties begin directly across the street from the refinery. Placing thousands of people at risk. And so that's actually under construction. We've been fighting it for more than a year down at Cove Point. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that they're all connected. If we want a healthier society, we've got to really come together, recognize the connections between these issues, and fight back against these. And that's, I think, why, for me, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is one of those struggles that has really brought a diverse, you know, number of organizations and issues together. And that's what it's going to take to change the political culture in this country and to actually start to create the positive changes that we need to see.
Can I respond to the first part of your question?
Sure. Sure thing.
Well, you said that, you know, the population seems like they're not active on this. And, you know, why is that? That people just accept it. And, you know, there's a reason why the government took the approach of secrecy throughout these last, you know, 5 years of negotiation, because they know that if the people knew it was in it, they would oppose it. And previous trade agreements have been defeated because people became aware and stopped them. If you look at popularresistance.org, as I said, our major primary website that links to its economy and the other things you mentioned, you'll see that the public really is in revolt It's not covering the corporate media. It's not covering the corporate media. So it looks like nothing's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But years and years of people being convinced they have no power
mm-hmm.
is changing. And as a result, you know, we did an article, I can't remember if it was the beginning of this year or the end of last year, but I did the article. It was an interview. It was an interview I did with Jack Rasmus about, you know, some hope for the future. And it's on Popular Resistance. And it gives examples of some of the successes that we've had. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's 14 states with the minimum wage going up because of the Fight for 15 and the Our Walmart protests. There's 24 states with new laws on police violence because of the Black Lives Matter movement. There's stopping
mm-hmm.
the Arctic drilling because of the Shell No protests. There's stopping the KXL. There's I keep listing more and more successes we've had. People are seeing they have power. And the government and the corporate media does not want us to know we have power. So they keep trying to suppress that. They keep trying to keep things in the dark so we don't know what's going on. But now the TPP is out, and now they're going after the KXL and these trade tribunal courts. I think that's going to get the climate justice movement even more involved than they've already been. We already had, you know, a movement of movements that flowed fast track for 2 to 3 years because they just couldn't get enough votes to pass it. And I think this movement of movements is getting stronger. In an election year, they're going to have a very hard time with this. I think Obama's optimistic that he can pass this, but I think he's going to have a much harder time than he realizes. People are more aware, and if people mobilize around this, I'm pretty confident we can stop it. And so I hope people will go to Flush the TPP and sign up.
They should go to Flush the TPP, and they can sign up, and then they'll receive a notice of different actions they can participate
in. Exactly.
What actions are going to be coming up over the next month, for example?
So one thing that people will get if they sign the pledge at Flush the TPP is that they'll be added to the email list, and we send out a weekly email that gives information as well as, you know, what's coming up. We also do a weekly national call on Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, which is an organizing call. February is going to be a very active month because, as we said at the beginning, President Obama and the other leaders of the TPP countries are going to meet in New Zealand on February 4th and sign the TPP. And then it has to go to each country for their process of ratification, which in the U.S. means passing some legislation through Congress. So on that day, February 4th, there are cities all across the country that are organizing protests. And if you go to flushthetpp.org to the actions page, you'll see a map that lists all of those various actions. It's not too late. If someone wants to organize an action locally and they don't see it on their map, they can contact us through Flush the TPP, and we'll be happy to work with them on organizing something. And then during President's Week, which is February 14th to the 21st, members of Congress are going to be in their home districts, and so people are also mobilizing to do actions at their member of Congress's offices. If their member has not come out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, then people have to assume that they are supporting it. And so one thing that people are doing for those members of Congress who are not opposed is asking them if they have read the agreement. We've seen some examples of members of Congress who were for it, and then after the text came out, they read it, and they were like, oh, this is not good. They finally got it. So
mm-hmm.
Really important for people to be persistent with their members of Congress, to push them to read the agreement, and then if they read it, how can they justify supporting it? So that's the next wave of action.
And if people have members of Congress who actually are on our side, then we're asking them to push them to take action, push their member of Congress to do something about it, to help organize other members of Congress, to educate other members of Congress. You know, being against it's great, but leadership in Congress is what's needed from those who already understand it. So we have whether your congressman is already for it or against it, there's reason to push them.
Yeah, so there's actually quite a lot that people can do. You know, the thing I feel about the work you're doing and this issue is, you know, there are many issues out there, and sometimes people, well, you know, they have a reason to be against, you know, a variety of issues, or they passionately care about food, or there's something going on in their community that must be addressed or dealt with. But to me, this is primary because it affects all the other issues. It's not surprising that a lot of people are coming together around this from all different areas. So instead of it just being one issue, one brand, but I'm, you know, for you, but I'm into something else. This is the thing is so bad and so widespread in its effects that it actually has something in it to galvanize almost anyone who cares about anything. You know, so, and if you haven't identified where the TPP and these treaties if passed will be undermining things that, you know, your health or your community or things that you care about, it's because, you know, you need to read more, and you can go to Popular Resistance and do that, and you need to learn more because chances are it's there. I mean, just the ones we've been covering, you know, really run the gamut. So my greatest hope has been because of that, that it would become the vehicle for different groups, each with their own brand, to sort of pull together and organize. You know, I'd love your thoughts about the contrast between, you know, the last show that I did on this issue, we had Bill Warren on, and he was talking about the fact that as the Paris Climate Conference was happening, these treaties were being negotiated, the TTIP, the European Treaty, was being negotiated behind closed doors right at the same time. So it, you know, it's kind of puts a dent in your idealism to be going, yay, hooray, people are finally talking about climate, and then find out that this is going on. But the antidote to that is really to get involved with this issue. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that we took this issue on years ago, not just because it's something that brings people together, but also because if it goes through, it's going to set our work back. So if you care about healthcare or food or education or the environment, the work that we've done to get to the point that we are at, and we still have a long way to go, will be reversed. So, and that's how we're going to start to change the power dynamic in this country. This is really what it's about, is that right now we have not a democracy, but what's called a plutocracy, where the wealthy are in control and the people's, you know, needs and desires are not being addressed by our government in large part. We need to change that, flip that scenario so that the policies that are put in place are benefiting people, protecting our communities. And so that's how we do this, by creating this groundswell of movement, of educated resistance, of creating alternatives in our communities to replace the dysfunctional systems that we have. So all the positive work that people are doing around urban agriculture and requiring labeling and putting in bike lanes and all those kinds of things, they're all part of a big movement for social change that's happening. So it's an exciting time, but it's also a very challenging time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things about the COP21 meetings on the climate in Paris, that was kind of like the elephant in the living room not discussed, was these trade agreements.
Mm-hmm.
Because these trade agreements will have a gigantic impact on climate legislation and climate policy. You know, if there's a lawsuit up in Canada where a U.S. corporation is suing because a Canadian province passed a law to ban fracking under a river. And they sue them over that. So environmental concerns like that, which are very much related to climate change, will be sued in these trade tribunals, and have an impact. So really, the thing about, you know, Paris had a lot of faults too. I mean, it was great. It was openly negotiated. We were given drafts halfway through, so people could see them and try to impact them. Even with the ban on protests, there still were some pretty impressive protests. So there was some ability of people to have an influence, but there were some major shortcomings, and obviously it was a shell of an agreement. At least they reached an agreement, but it's a shell that now has to be filled in by legislation back in people's home countries. Well, that legislation will be very, very hard to put in place if you have these trade agreements signed and ratified and becoming the law that essentially puts a block on the kind of policies we need. Because if you're going to do we have to do a major shift, I mean, to a clean energy economy, a carbon and nuclear-free energy economy, and that means that existing corporate powers, the nuclear industry, the gas industry, the oil industry, the frackers, the tar sanders, the offshore drillers, all those people are going to be adversely affected by solving the climate problem. And that means every time you pass a new law that minimizes them, weakens them, you are risking a lawsuit in a rigged trade tribunal with corporate lawyers as your judges. So it's a big, big problem. It was never mentioned, at the COP21, even though it basically is a trump card that overrules everything they're going to try to do to make the COP21 mean something as far as a transition to a carbon-free, nuclear-free, clean energy economy.
Yep, I totally see that, and I get that, and it is just it's kind of like we want to have the good news, so it's kind of like shush, don't interfere with my good news. I have so little of it, you know, and that's you know it's an understandable human emotion, but you know what is the point of the good news if it's being trumped? You know, you just have to kind of take that lump and really, you know, kind of look at it and stuff like that. And I think on Popular Resistance, you make it really easy, and Flush the TPP, you make it really easy for people to do that. And it's essential. It's absolutely essential. We've got about another 5 minutes for our show here. So, you know, do you want to... you know, talk a little bit more about what some benchmarks are, where people need to be, put it on their calendar, be alert, be active, you know, be ready for what's coming.
Sure, thank you. And I also wanted to respond to what you just said, because it can be really hard as people get their eyes opened and start to realize, you know, just what it is that we're facing and just how little, you know, these transnational corporations care about our safety and our well-being. That can be daunting, but at the same time, if your listeners, if any of them have not gotten involved in activism, which can be both, you know, resisting things like the TPP, but also creating alternatives that are positive, that's a complete antidote. When people get out there and start to feel their power, start to put in, you know, build community, put in place, you know, new things or stop harmful things, it's really... it really makes people feel good and feel stronger. And so I urge people to do that. Now, we have these local actions coming up in February, and then we're going to have to keep our eyes open to see when the president sends the implementing legislation to Congress, because that will start the 90-day clock ticking. People should actually be pushing their members of Congress now, but if it actually goes before Congress, we'll have to push even harder. We do have the Wednesday night organizing calls that your listeners can join. They can learn about that at Flush the TPP. And we're already starting to talk about our next wave of action after the February actions. What do we do to escalate and build and continue? Because the way we actually defeat this agreement is very unsatisfying, I should say. We defeat the agreement not by having it voted down in Congress. If it goes to Congress, that makes it hard. We defeat it by delay and delay and delay, by pushing it back, you know, making them the president believe that he doesn't have the votes to passing it, and just keep pushing it back, and that's how it will finally wither away and disappear.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize that now is the time to push. That the key is to stop Obama from going to Congress, and the key to that is him being convinced he doesn't have the votes. And so now is the time to push. People should be calling their member of Congress every day or every few days or every week. They should be, whenever there's a congressional break, reaching out to their the local staff to meet with them and tell them this TPP has got to be stopped, you know, and organize your community so that you come not alone but with other people to stand up to this TPP and the other trade agreements, so that the Congress member sees that the community is getting organized against him if he goes the wrong way on this. And so now is the time to push, and to keep pushing throughout the rest of this year. Well, you know, when we get to the lame duck session, we'll look at that and see what the politics are there. There may be some issues we need to worry about then. There may not be. We'll see. And then, of course, we get into 2017. If they reopen the negotiations, then all bets are off. This is a very fragile agreement. They had a hard time reaching agreement, the various nations involved. If you start to open it up, it could all fall apart. So I think we have a real chance of defeating this, which would be a tremendous, tremendous people power victory over transnational corporate power. It should give people a sense that they actually do have power, even in this corrupt government, that if we work together, we can defeat the things that the corporations want most, and they want this a lot. So it's going to be a very big battle in 2016 and maybe 2017.
Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots. Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, Popular Resistance and Flush the TPP. It's just been terrific having you. Thank you for your years and years of tremendous work. And I have to really second the fact that watching, you know, how this thing keeps getting pushed down the line has been amazing and impressive. And with more people involved and taking action regularly, it's, if you follow the shows before and are kind of now touching back in, now is the time. Thank you so much for all your fine work and for being on the show with me today and our listeners on Connect the Dots. And I want to
thank you.
Yeah, great. Well, I always picture that picture of Margaret in Congress holding up the sign. It's a viral photo of you guys in action. It's just amazing. Thank you, listeners, and thank you for your action. And actually, one of the things that I say about activism, and it's really true with our guests today, is that you meet the best people. You know, there's this idea that, you know, you're angry or it's distressing or it's depressing, and, you know, sometimes any of those emotions can come into it, but actually it's really uplifting because you meet the best people, because the best people are involved and engaged and really working hard to protect our humanity and life on Earth. So thank you for being with us today on Connect the Dots, listeners, and we'll be back again next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network with Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Leafy.